With No Man's Sky, it's like 100% accept that it's like basically a boring game, but I really like it.
You do talk about it for a while. Yes, you do.
It's good. New patch came out.
Anyway. Hey, welcome to Front Seat Gamer. I'm Nick. I'm here with Paul.
Hey.
And Blake.
Hey.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
What good. Episode number are we?
177. Good. Wow. Thank you, Paul.
Oh, wow.
Whew. I know where I was.
Saved it.
Yeah. So,
someone,
nice.
Someone at home is like, they've got their checklist and they're taking all the things and I didn't say that. And they're like, what's going on? What's happening?
There was a time on...
I panicked a little bit.
There was a time where a couple episodes back, I put the... last year, I put an episode number on wrong and didn't realize for like a month. Nothing happened.
No one commented.
No one commented.
None of our five listeners.
But I saw it and was like, wait a minute, something's wrong here.
You guys playing stuff?
I have been playing stuff, but don't we have a few questions we want to do up
front? You want to do questions first?
I like questions up front.
All right.
That's a good idea.
This could derail the whole episode.
I don't think so. Unless it's about Elden Ring or... Well, I don't think
it. Luckily, this first one isn't. The second one is. This is from Slippery Jim 8. He said, okay, I'm only 2 minutes in. I've been a big proponent for Pepsi milk for many years now. That feels weird to type. It's great. I got a friend to try it, and he vomited. Turns out if you put the milk in first, then the Pepsi, that shit curdles immediately. I don't know who in their right mind looks at an obviously curdled drink and decides to drink it, but I can only assume everyone that hates Pepsi milk has just made it wrong.
Maybe.
I think he kind of asks and answers his own question. He says, I don't know who in their right mind looks at an obviously curdled drink and decides to drink it. But he also says he got his friend to do it.
And they
did exactly that.
Yeah.
So, Slippery Jim, your friend is the kind of person who does that.
But he would have done that under the insistence of Slippery Jim saying, no, it's good. Trust me. It's amazing. And then he tries it and looks at it and saying, this looks curdled, but my friend is saying it's good. I'm going to try it.
It's like literally drinking bad milk.
Yeah.
Drinking the whole milk, bad milk, and going, oh, I don't like milk.
But, like, people do drink curdled milk and things, right?
No.
I don't think so. Maybe. Look, this sounds like you've anywhere is going to be some Scandinavian.
You've been vegan for too long, Paul.
Maybe I have.
I swear
there's a thing with, like, split milk and something.
I bet there is. But I bet it's like one of those niche things, like the fermented fish type things, you know, where it's like people do it.
But it's not bad. It's just that it's separated.
It's bad.
What?
It's bad.
Okay.
Like curdled milk is bad. It smells horrible. It smells like rotting milk.
Right at the moment.
But you mean, is it bad for you?
No, I just mean at the point where you add too much acid and it splits. Does it immediately just go gross?
Yes. There's a difference between like if you're making cheese and you have the curds in the whey, but then there's curdled milk is not necessarily the same as, I guess it can be, but like when milk goes bad, it also curdles.
Yes, but that's different, right?
Yes, but what I'm saying is imagine someone who drinks sour milk and then goes, boy, I sure hate milk,
because
that's the scenario here. But I did hear that sour milk is used as an ingredient, apparently a very important ingredient, in Irish soda bread. I don't know why.
Soda bacteria bread. Or something.
My mum used to make Irish soda bread, and I did not like it.
Really, what did it taste like?
Like star anise, or like an aniseed, rather. I guess it just I don't like that flavor that much.
Licorice bread.
Yeah, I don't think that's it. I don't want that. No, thank you. So that's question one. Okay, so this is next question or comment or whatever you want to call it. This is from Ayn Hassad. I believe this person, I would say fairly called me out about my thoughts on Elden Ring, but I strongly disagreed still. And he says, I wasn't fully understanding Nick's argument until I heard what he says around 20 minutes into the last podcast. I think that I get his point now. I think that if you look at Baldur's Gate 3, that game gives you hints on how to do a lot of stuff, and that game isn't cryptic enough where you would have a miserable individual experience playing it. But also, Baldur's Gate 3 doesn't give you too many hints to the point where the community experience would be worse. Because what would be the point of having a community talking about a game if the game told you how to do everything in detail? That would be nothing. There would be nothing to discuss. I feel like there is a balance there, and you can have both experiences at the same time within a game. And people saying that Elden Ring is a game made intentionally cryptic for the community to figure out is perhaps just copium, because the game could be good from both angles. Correct. That's pretty much that's pretty much on the money. It I think Baldur's Gate 3 is an amazing example,
yeah,
because there are so many things, little tiny details. It's a game built around giving the player vast numbers of options and the game responding to those options. And just the other day, I saw a thing. There's a character in Act 2. Hey, Paul, have you played Baldur's Gate
3? Yeah, I didn't get very far, though. Okay. I think I got up to the start of Act 2 and stopped playing.
Okay, something. Well, you might want to cover your ears if you don't want to spoil anything.
I probably won't get back to it.
That's cool. There's a guy called Balthazar in Act 2. Terrifying looking. His face is all carved up. Real psychotic character. He talks about, when you first meet him, he talks about how he has his mother in a jar behind him. And you can also just, you can take the jar that has his mother in it, and then you can talk to him. And then when he says that, you can say, like, but I have your mother. And then he rages.
Oh, wow.
And starts attacking you. That's just a thing that can happen, right? And they have a dialogue option to support it. It's an amazing game. That is a game that I think used early access to its fullest capacity, in which they give players plenty of play time. They gather player data. They look at what players are trying, and then they build responses to what players want to do. Brilliant.
Yeah, there was a lot of, I do remember them saying there was a lot of players saying, like, we want to be able to do this.
Yes.
And they'll just,
just do it. You know? I remember looking up something, because I got some item and I was like curious what would happen if I tried to use it on these different characters. And they were I saw a thread from years ago, because the game had been in early access for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. Ages, yeah.
And players were like, I wish I could do it on this character. But the version I was playing, you could. And I was like, cool. Like, yeah. That's a perfect example. Like,
there are a few times when I Googled things and found the thread of people talking about what it would be cool if you could do.
Yeah. And I think that's, it's really an interesting way to develop a game, and one that kind of both relies on a very committed community that is also kind of critically small enough that you can do this without spoiling it for a larger community later.
Yeah.
I'll read one more comment.
Sure, yep.
This is from Aiden Sichi 9327. He said, I'd be curious to hear Nick's thoughts on the combat loop. I'm assuming he's talking about Elden Ring. I've always found the dodge roll that allows you to dodge by turning you into an immortal god so that enemy weapons pass harmlessly through your chest, combined with enemies that do your entire HP bar and damage when you have almost instant heal flasks, to be ridiculous. Why give bosses giant AoE attacks if you're going to dodge them with a roll that dodges everything the same? Why make them do so much damage when you'll bring like 10 health pots into every fight minimum? Combat feels like it started with a bad decision, then had band-aids applied to it. Armored Core 6 is amazing, though. Have Nick try that next. Again, great points. And I basically agree. I think, I think Elden Ring's combat gets a lot more credit than I would personally give it. I think Elden Ring's combat strengths is the way that different weapon sets feel. And the way that you can... You kind of have to relearn timings for each different kind of weapon set.
It's, for me, the combat is all just timing.
It is. That's it. It is a pure timing challenge.
And I get frustrated if I feel like the boss is unfairly sort of messing with the timing.
Yeah. You often talk about the first boss. Stormveil Castle, who will feint his attacks.
Yep. I hate it.
He'll lift his weapon up, and instead of striking at the same time he does every time, he will hover for a second, or he'll put it back down.
I hate it. Drives me insane, and I hate that fight because of it. Because I could never get into a rhythm of that fight, and when I beat him, I didn't feel satisfied. I just felt like I'd fluked it. I have no idea. I didn't feel like I'd mastered it. A lot of like FromSoft game, a lot of like Dark Souls bosses, I feel like you master them. You try them a bunch of times, and you get into a rhythm with them, and you feel like you master them, and I've always felt like it would be a cool thing to just be able to redo boss fights. Like, as a mode, you know, mm-hmm. like you finish the game. And, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can just like, just basically for fun, because the boss fights, once you master them, are very enjoyable. But I a lot of them, I'm not saying all.
Some of them.
Yeah. Just, yeah. I mean, that's.
I would argue, though, I did one boss fight about the same thing about six times.
Yeah.
I talk about it every time. The ulcerated tree spirit.
Right. Yeah.
And that's not a fun fight. Any of the times I did it.
I know.
They kept putting it in front of me.
But that's also to my point, is that I felt like in Elden Ring there were more bosses that I just was frustrated with than in other FromSoft games. Yeah. And I think it's because it's leaning so much into that, oh, this is a tough game. This is like expecting people to have years and years worth of like Dark Souls experience behind them. So it's like the first boss will make it, you know, it's going to fake out attacks constantly, and like you never get into a good rhythm with it.
The other thing I think that people don't talk about enough is how wildly off their attack signaling and effects are to their actual hitbox.
Mm.
Like, it looks like you should be able to roll away from attack. It looks like you're well out of the attack range.
Oh, yeah, and it'll get you. Yeah.
And the fact that oftentimes the correct thing to do is roll towards the enemy for whatever reason, like that, a thing they constantly want players to do.
Mm. Which is annoying. When you get like a giant, you get a real giant boss and it's like, okay, you basically hug their legs.
Yes.
That's the biggest pain in the ass to fight, because you literally can't see what they're signaling.
Can't see anything.
Yeah.
And oftentimes the most effective way to beat a boss is hug the ankles slightly to the side of their, like basically stand side to side and just beat up the side of their ankle.
Yeah.
And the game's camera is not built for that.
No.
But the game's combat is built to force that.
It is
weirdly incongruous.
Yeah.
And it takes these beautiful landscapes, this gorgeous, like the art direction's amazing.
Mm.
The animations are fluid and like fantastic and fun to watch. And when you're actually fighting a thing the way you have to beat it, you don't see any of that.
No.
You see a toe.
Yep.
And usually a lot of details being put into that toe for some reason.
Yeah.
Probably because that's all you're going to see.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh boy, I got to put more work into this toe.
It's a good toe. But then you might get that toe as a weapon after.
Yeah, a toe or a finger.
Yeah.
A lot of fingers and toes in that game.
There is. Yeah. It's a real theme going on with that.
That's enough Elden Ring, right?
Yeah.
I think that's, we've got some other questions, but we can get to them next time.
Yep.
So what you been playing?
Paul, have you been playing anything?
I've been playing the Final Fantasy VII remake.
Oh!
Quite a bit.
How is it?
Last weekend, I'm actually really enjoying it. So I tried playing it when it first came out.
Yep.
Being like, oh man, I really just want to do Final Fantasy VII again. They've like remade it. It's going to be great. It's not that. And at first, that was very jarring.
Yeah.
I played it for like 10 hours and just gave up.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But then Rebirth came out recently, which is the second part of three parts, each $140 New Zealand dollars.
Man,
a part.
This is going to be an expensive game. I love
5 years apart or whatever.
Final Fantasy VII was a pretty big game for me as a kid. So I was still, with part two coming out, I was like, I'll just go back, give it another go. And this time, I'm really enjoying it.
Cool.
It's kind of weird. It's more story focused than, like, it doesn't feel like a JRPG at all.
Wow.
There's none of that sort of just go around talking to lots of people.
It's like the quintessential JRPG,
though. Yeah, I was going to say, story-focused is like mostly what a JRPG is, right?
Yeah, but this is all cutscenes rather than being...
That's totally tracking with JRPG.
Oh, well...
Than
the historic ones where you're like a...
Talk to NPC.
Character.
But that's only because they didn't have the technology to just have constant cutscenes.
Yeah.
They just had to have the little speech bubble.
There's so many cutscenes. Mm. But like now that I'm leaning into it, it's awesome. Okay. It feels like I'm playing through just like the story.
Yeah.
And not in a jarring way like God of War felt like. Like God of War.
Which one?
Shout out to the episode. The one with all the cutscenes.
Yeah.
No, I started playing God of War 2. When that came out a couple years ago? It was a couple years ago?
Do you mean Ragnarok?
Yeah.
Because God of War 2 is a different game.
Yes, Ragnarok.
Okay. Ragnarok.
That one.
Okay.
Look, it's fine. This...
I feel so justified bringing it up.
I know, right?
This is the only one I know of.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
I think I talked about it. I played 2018 God of War recently. And there are a lot of cutscenes. But I also really enjoyed how well blended the cutscenes were into the gameplay.
Yeah.
The no cutaways, like making it all feel flow seamlessly. From
yeah, I thought the first one was really good at that. The second one, they did too many at the start and I stopped playing.
Mm.
But Final Fantasy VII, it does, like it feels like there's too many, but at the same time I'm enjoying the entire thing. So I can't actually criticize that.
Now, I'm kind of I'm vaguely interested in it. I really enjoyed Final Fantasy VII when it first came out.
Yeah.
Or I guess like 2 years after it first came out.
Yeah.
I played it on PC. You know, I did everything in that game. I bred chocobos, did all the chocobo racing, did all the mini games, did all the things. Loved it. I remember just grinding because back then my brother would not let me get past him in games.
Hmm.
I
had a habit of
beating his game before him. Or getting further than him, and like he would feel like I was spoiling whatever it was, and I remember he was up to, I think the city was called Junon, it's a giant cannon, city, and so I couldn't go into that city. That was my red line, and so I was just grinding monsters outside there, and I found Yuffie.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And he hadn't found Yuffie, and that, of course, bothered him.
Wow.
But like, you know, I would just grind monsters in that game. So I really like that game. What I've seen of the most recent Final Fantasy VII, like Rebirth, they have really ramped up the wackiness. And that's already a fairly wacky game.
It was already a real wacky game. Or am I thinking of other Final Fantasies?
I think Final Fantasy VII is probably one of the wackier ones in that era.
Because even in the first one, and in the first remake, there's like a pretty big point pretty early on in the game where it's like, okay, you've got to fight a house.
Oh, yeah. I remember those. Oh, yeah. Man, that is weird.
There's wacky, and then there's also like we're throwing all of our ideas into a pot because we don't really know what we're doing.
To be fair, if I remember
it's such a Final Fantasy thing, though. They had always there'd weird be a point enemies. Where you fight a boat or a house.
If I remember right, though, that house was in the slums area, so it makes...
It was a.
It's in where you would imagine a house that attacks you be.
It looked like a park, like a playground house.
Yeah,
but it had like a gun coming out the window or something.
So weird. Yep.
It's so weird.
And you fought it in the arena, I think.
Maybe
the arena combat thing is. You're talking about like the golden
Colosseum.
Colosseum.
This is in the remake.
Is it Colosseum in the remake?
Well, it's just a thing you go and you can do fights.
Okay, cool. They had the Golden Saucer combat arena thing, which I always really like.
The Golden Saucer one.
So we're getting off topic here, but
not really.
The Golden Saucer. Fair point, Paul. <We're> still, Golden Saucer had, and also that wouldn't even be weird for this podcast. Golden Saucer had. Had this thing where you would do like 8 rounds of combat, and it was like how you I think you had to get like it was some really difficult and powerful material you can get if you did all 8 rounds.
And that's ringing a bell now.
Each round would be a harder monster than the last.
Yeah.
But on top of that, between rounds, there would be a wheel you would spin, and the wheel would apply like a modifier for the next fight. Right? And they were cumulative. Which I thought it's actually a really good system. So like you'd beat a really basic enemy and then you'd roll the wheel and it would be like, now you have half attack and you have half attack for the rest of the next 7 fights.
This is really ringing a bell now.
Now you're a frog and you're a frog for the rest of the fights. And I'm pretty sure you had to play as only Cloud. If I recall, you didn't even get the whole party. It was like, you were just Cloud for those.
For the series of 8 fights.
Anyway, that was, I really like that system. Real hard, but also kind of weirdly luck-based.
This is, a way easier version of that.
Okay.
They have certain matchups. So there's, the first three you have to do individually as either Cloud or Barrett or Tifa.
Yep.
But there'll be five rounds. It's pretty easy monsters, and you heal 50% of health and mana in between each round. There's that no increase.
Much
difference.
Easier.
but they do ramp up in difficulty. Yep. So that's just like the one star difficulty one. Sure. They have like crazy rewards as well. Like I didn't discover it until like the second place. The second time I went back to that place, and the first rewards are like new limit breaks.
Mm.
So
new isn't like. When
upgrades to the limit breaks.
Interesting.
Yeah. So,
okay. So I
worth doing.
What I've seen from the rebirth, they've added like tons of mini games, and this is a game that already had a lot of mini games in it.
Mm.
Oftentimes, mini games that would be tied into the core story as well. Yeah. Like there was a marching mini game when you get to Junon City.
Oh yeah.
Where you had to like march in time with the rest of the soldiers, which was probably a lot easier when you had an analog controller and weren't playing on PC.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They've added so many more.
Hmm.
They've got one where you get turned into a frog and you have to leap over obstacles with the rest of the group. They've got one where you're turned into a toy, and I don't really know. I've just seen screenshots of these. There's one where I'm pretty sure like you ride a dolphin. I don't know, man.
Wow.
It's basically like a wave race.
Aren't you supposed to be saving the world in this game?
Yeah.
Just taking some time out to be a dolphin.
Yeah, you know, Sephiroth out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very much a game of like, you're meant to be saving the world, but also there's some stuff you can do over there. And it's mini games and it's silly and it's fun.
I do think about how like Act 4 or Disc 4 of Final Fantasy 7, there is a meteor hovering above the planet.
Yeah, there's a clear ticking time bomb.
And I'm like, I'm going to go breed chocobos for the next few months.
Yep. And then explore all the rest of the world that I haven't been able to yet, because now I finally have the golden chocobo.
Yeah. I'm gonna go and get my enemy skill materia maxed out.
So yeah.
I'm gonna get hit by every enemy in the game. Is that cool?
Yep. That is I think we've talked about this, right? Like I have a real problem with games that like the storyline makes it seem urgent, but the actual game cannot be like isn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there are flip sides, right? Like Majora's Mask.
Mm, yeah. That's a good.
There is
a
constant timer, and oftentimes what you want to do is you want to go and do the bow mini game. You want to shoot rupees, but the moon is literally crashing down.
Yeah. And it will.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
That I'm okay with because that's like real. You know, that's like, okay, there is a ticking time bomb and it's real.
Yeah.
And it's part of the whole game.
But
I'm talking about a time bomb where it's like, oh, we've got to do this thing, you know, we've got to rush and do this thing. But actually, that thing won't even trigger unless you basically like activate that quest, you know.
It's interesting to bring this up because I've been playing Persona 5.
Mm.
And they have they have a timer system.
Mm.
Like every day you have like basically morning and afternoon. And you can do a task, a major task in each. But there's, I assume, a hard timer. Like there will be an end point where,
because
the story kind of ticks along
at a
fixed rate.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about this. I have weird feelings about this.
Mm.
I don't usually get like decision paralysis in a game. So for example, Baldur's Gate 3 presents dozens and dozens, hundreds of choices to the player all the time. And I don't feel the sort of anxiety about making a choice in Baldur's Gate 3 that I do in Persona. And I think the big difference is timer.
Mm.
Even though I make a choice in Baldur's Gate 3, it is permanent,
and
I will live with that choice, and I will go on and do whatever. Persona will... You know there's a timer, so when you make a choice, you know that you are excluding other progression elements.
Mm.
And I think that's also part of it. Persona really makes visible a lot of these progression elements. When I'm talking to an NPC, it'll be like, oh, you can't quite raise this person's level yet or whatever. Or this one's ready to go. It's gamifying a lot of these like sort of pseudo-social elements. Mm. It's like, who do I want to befriend? I'm not doing it because I want to befriend this character because I like the character. I'm doing it because It's maybe more optimal for my gameplay experience,
yep.
mm.
which is very different to Baldur's Gate,
mm.
where they hide most of these things until after the fact.
Yeah.
I think there's two elements here. One mm. is time pressure when there's multiple choices and mm. you know that you can't do them all within the time window feels worse than multiple choices with no time pressure, mm. even though they're still exclusionary.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other element here is giving the player more information can be worse for their experience
mm.
if part of that is exclusionary.
Well, if they know what they're missing, yes. that's the problem.
Mm. Yes.
Baldur's Gate, you don't know what you're missing until something happens in
or
the
even
future.
Then, you may not know.
Or maybe you just don't know, yeah.
I'm not going to give any specifics, but there is a character that I talked to in Act 1, and then I talked to them again in Act 2, and I made a choice to kill them in Act 2.
Mm.
And I didn't realize this, but I could have not killed them in Act 2 and had a very different mm. experience in Act 3.
Mm.
Awesome. I didn't know this until after the fact.
Mm.
I think that's so cool. But if Persona had presented that, they would have probably said something like, if you do this now, you're going to miss out on this thing mm. in Act 3. And I'd be like, well, shoot, I don't know what to do now.
Well, there is a thing in Baldur's Gate that gives me a slight... what would you call it? Anxiety of around
like,
that?
There's a thing called
FOMO.
FOMO.
FOMO where before you leave that sort of very first yes. map, it yes. says you're about to progress the story. Make sure you've wrapped yes. up stuff.
Yes.
And that makes me think like basically just go around for another hour making sure I've done yeah. everything. Like yeah. and I don't like that.
Yes.
And then when I went through that area, I could just go back anyway. It yes. was like, it was not actually that more.
However, you can't do that for Act 3.
Yeah.
But Act 3, you can't go back to Act 2,
mm.
which was surprising to me because that wasn't the case for Act 2.
Yeah, I know, right? Like the game had taught you that, oh, you can go back until the final one where actually you can't go back.
So this comes back to if you tell the player too much,
mm.
they're going to change their behaviors. And if you don't tell the player, if you change the rules on them, there's going to be some fallout mm. from that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really interesting seeing sort of comparing these two games.
Yeah. That thing in Baldur's Gate is very weird that they say you're going to progress the story, so make sure you've wrapped up quests. Yeah. And then the area you're in, you can just go back
there
anyway. Like it seems like wrong.
I think the thing they're talking about there are certain storylines that are irreversible. So, for example, you go to Act 2.
Yes, but that's going fully to Act 2. There's that mountain area.
Yeah.
That when you enter that, it says that same thing, but that yeah. is basically still part of Act 1.
Yeah, it is a weird one. I don't really know what's going on
like,
there.
Like going to Moonrise, that's sure, because sure, it's sure, like sure. this whole thing, it's been like the final thing of the act where you're yeah. like, okay, now we're moving on. Yeah. And you're yeah. like, okay, that's cool. I understand that. But when you just walk through a road and you click on a entranceway and it says, make sure you're about to progress the story. Make yep. sure you've wrapped up all your quests. You start to panic and go, sure, I don't want to do that yet.
Yep.
And you postpone it for ages, like interrupting the flow of the game.
Yeah.
And like,
I wonder if it's because, the barrier between that, like the core of Act 1 and that click wall
mm.
and, that click wall and the next click wall to Act 2. Like, mm. the gap is much smaller. Like, mm. you can go from that click wall to, like, Moonrise
yeah.
without ever going to the monastery.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you go to the left yeah. path instead of the right,
yeah.
you end up in Moonrise.
And I just don't think it should be based on where you are in the map. It should just be based on story. Like, if you went to Moonrise
yeah.
before... You wrapped up Act 1.
Yeah, I do wonder about, like, what if I skip everything?
And yeah.
I just walk straight through.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, I mean, it would just change the things of, like, okay, those people wouldn't be at that camp in Act 1. You'd just be walking around, and there'd be high-level monsters there, so you'd be like, crap, I need to turn back.
Yeah.
But then later on when they're talking about, oh, we need to find a path to Moonrise, you're like, hey, I've already scouted out a path to Moonrise, basically.
Yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting one. There may be really legitimate design reasons for preventing that. Like,
or it could just be a small oversight.
It
sounds like one of those things where if you're reading through a bunch of feedback, your people are being like, oh, actually, I really wanted to be able to go back and just do this thing, even though we've already, so then they allow you to go back and then no one updates the prompt. That's
it,
like,
does, it does feel like that to me. Like it was maybe that at some point that did progress the story.
Yeah.
And they just still have that in.
It might also be that like, there are elements that do carry across that are more subtle. Like Lazelle has a lot of story in that monastery area.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in order for all of that to work, you have to have met Lazelle. You may have to have done some things that you may not have realized you did in Act One.
Yeah.
With Lazelle.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
But also that game, that entire game is all about decisions, making decisions that you can't go back from.
Yes.
So it's weird to have that milestone there being like, oh, this one, by the way, you can't go back from.
Yeah.
But you can. But you actually can.
But you actually can. Yeah. But also everything else that you've said and done. Woo.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a real weird one. I know there are NPCs that move out of Act 1 into Act 2 when you click on certain things. So, like the whole grove, right?
Yeah. But that's... I mean, do they? Like, that's the thing. You'd have to... I guess I'd have to go... Like, if you just went a beeline for Moonrise,
right?
Would the Grove
actually be there?
That's my question. That's the thing. Yeah. Because I prefer games where, if you're moving from Act 1 and Act 2 and onwards, it is not by clicking on a area transition.
Yeah, it's like, a narrative thing.
It's an actual narrative thing where you've talked to someone, you've completed a quest, and now they're like, all right, we're ready to go.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, if you've got anything you want to do, wrap it up because we're going to leave.
Yeah.
And that just feels more natural than, oh, don't go beyond this like gate because the world's going to change.
All of a sudden, a meteor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have gone through that door.
Oh, didn't you know?
Interesting one. I'm curious. Now we're back to just guessing about games.
Yes. That's so very much in line.
I am off the rails
and guessing. That's what we do best.
Now I'm curious what happens if you just beeline straight through. Like, I'm pretty sure you can go straight to Act 3 from Act 2. Like, you just have to kind of know.
Well, there's a giant camp. There's a giant camp of goblins in the way. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
There is the area transition.
Yeah.
But there is a giant camp there. Yes. So I never clicked on it because I actually didn't realize that was an area transition. I thought I could walk into that camp and kill them.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, I'll
that not, seems not big. Do that. I don't think I'm ready for that.
And then when I actually got there, the camp had moved on.
Yeah.
And there was an area transition there. And I was like, oh, that was never actually like an interactable thing. It was just there. But guessing again, I would bet that if you clicked on that, they'd say, there's a giant camp there. We shouldn't go there.
Yeah, it could be. But then what happens if you join the dark side?
Yeah, right? Well, that's the whole game then. It's just like, what happens if you do that?
Good game.
It is a great game. Like, I really want to like join the dark side, kill all the druids, see what happens, man. Just
yep, you can do it.
Great game.
So you've been so Final Fantasy VII, huh?
Well, what happens? Okay, in Final Fantasy VII, what progresses into the next thing in Final Fantasy VII?
There are bits where it's like, if you go down this, it'll be like the story will tell you that you need to go down this thing, and then you'll get a prompt being like, if you go down that thing, you won't be able to come back here. And it does have a bunch of things that weather world changes.
Yeah.
So there's no time constraints or anything, though. Mm. So you can just go do the weird chin up mini game.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at that point,
before you go to save someone.
Yeah, like, I guess at that point, right before the meteor shows up, or
was what? So this the meteor is act like disc three or whatever, right?
Yeah, and this is the first part of the remake, so I'm not even on to the second one yet. So
isn't there also isn't there also a part where there's like a big Godzilla thing marching towards the city?
Yep.
I remember that's that same city, right? The Junon.
Yep.
Yeah.
I remember again. I think that's the end of the second disc. Now I'm very curious because they've done a completely different like structure for this, right?
Mm. Yes, it is a very different game. I don't know where it's going to go or how it's going to go, but there's little twists to everything.
Yeah.
And then I think it was you that mentioned that the ghost things are trying to keep the story on track. There's all these ghosts that show up.
Someone had told me about that.
Yeah, so I ended up Googling it because I was curious as well, and that seems to be the case. I'm nowhere near far enough into the story to like be sure yet, but there's lots of points in the story where it looks like you go do something and then these ghosts force you not to, so that key points are still happening.
Yeah,
that's so weird.
It's I kind of like that, but I kind of, I mean, look, I haven't played it, and I want to play it at some point, but it's like, sounds like it's going to be about 100.
I mean, you're playing Persona, so
200 hours of.
Yeah, you're playing Persona,
it's actually
so that's
not
already
that long.
The first one is not that long.
Yeah,
and then the second one is pretty long, as far as I understand.
I thought it was about the same. I looked it up.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I think so. Both estimates seem to be around 30 something hours.
Okay.
Including
and it's $140.
Yes.
Oh man.
I do think I got it. So this is also on PlayStation, right? Like PlayStation, you pay more anyway.
Yeah.
But that's a lot.
And
more.
I did manage to get it for cheaper. It just retails for $140.
Yeah. Well,
or maybe if you buy it online, it's $140.
I am curious, how far they will go down that route. My dream is you've got Final Fantasy VII as a story. And then the remake version is like an alternate reality version of Final Fantasy VII, where like for whatever reason that they tie in this whole ghost element and things start to go off the rails in the latter half or whatever, you know, and they start to diverge in a really important way and in a way that unifies the two games, where you still get glimpses of the original but have a totally new experience. That would be a very interesting.
It's like it's not a remake, but a sequel.
Yeah, or
like you play the first one, you know, and then you play this one, and things are slightly different. And and if they do converge, it's like, oh, they're actually all basically the one game in a way.
I'm thinking kind of the opposite. They don't converge. They kind of they start to split apart.
Yeah. Right,
and it's like.
No, but I mean, I don't mean converge as in like storylines. I mean converge as in like, oh, you see elements of the previous one that you had played, so they are connected in that way.
Yes.
Quite early on, you get a flashback cutscene to something that happens much later in the original game.
Oh.
So, and like that doesn't happen in the first game.
Huh.
So, that's all really weird.
Wow.
And again, Fauna is someone that really enjoyed but I mean, it's until they finished the third part,
it's
and
all
another
guessing,
$110 later and another 30 hours or whatever.
The third part, right? It's an interesting one because, again, where they are leaving off the second part is where the first disc of the original ends.
Right.
And then there's two more discs of the original.
Yes.
So the original ends with basically spoilers for the 25-year-old game, Aerith/Aerith dies, and then disc one ends.
Yep.
And I believe that's where part two of the Final Fantasy remake ends.
Oh, interesting.
Which means you don't have like this is all from memory. So you'll have like Reunion, you'll have the Meteor, you'll have like. The whole sub-story where Cloud gets lost in the Mako.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And you don't have Cloud for a while, and you're flying around on Cid's ship.
Yep.
You'll have, like, the whole walking through the snowfield thing.
Oh, I forgot about that.
There's a lot. I think the Ancient Temple is in first disc. But there's just a ton of, there's a Yuffie's Town.
Wutai,
yes, with like the giant fighting statues that you can walk on. There's just tons and tons and tons of content that is post.
Also, that what's that place with the weird mini game where you had to? So you would like buy units or something, and
Fort Condor.
Yes,
loved Fort Condor.
Yes, so did I.
And the thing about Fort Condor is, it took me ages to figure out how to even do the minigame.
Yes,
because you had to. I don't remember if you had to talk to specific NPCs or if it was tied to story progression. But like, you go there really early, and they're talking about you'll be able to. They give you the whole spiel, the whole tutorial. You'll buy. This is how you buy units. This is how you place them, and then you can't do anything with it.
Hmm.
for ages. Yeah, you have to like come back later.
Yeah, oh, wow, it is. I think a story thing or something. Yeah. Like something's attacking in the real world, and then you've got to go there, and the way you actually defend it is not fight the thing; is to play that mini game.
It's an RTS. It's actually a tower defense.
Yes,
it's like a very early tower defense.
Yes, it is.
Oh, I think I vaguely remember that.
That it would be in part two.
Yep,
if it exists. But there's just so much that the second disc contained, and then there's the third disc, and admittedly, the third disc is basically the end of the game plus a cutscene.
Yes.
But I am very curious how they're going to fit all of that into part three in a way that doesn't drag.
Because
there's a lot of storytelling that happens in that second disc.
I mean, is it only, how many parts are they going to be?
Three.
That's what they've said. I wonder if they're going to do part three, part one.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to do that.
So there was a weird thing with the first one that I'm playing. It looks like I can start a new game where it only tells Yuffie's story.
Whoa, what?
It doesn't seem
to be... She's not even in the first...
No, so
just
it's
her off somewhere else.
Released as like...
As a DLC or something?
Yeah. Wow. I haven't actually checked it out at all, so I don't know what happens in it. So I can like only speculate. I just know that
whoa.
I'm in the title screen...
We don't
do
speculating on this podcast.
When I'm in the title screen, it's like I noticed in the top right, it's like press R1 to do retrograde or something. Wow. And I clicked it, and it's like this tells the story of Yuffie, and nothing is explained. So if you haven't done the first one, good luck or something.
That does seem like DLC.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
You clicked on it. Right.
I only pushed the R1 to go to, I mean, that creates, it just takes you to the title screen of that. there's this little description saying.
Do you have the DLC of it? Can you actually start playing it?
I didn't pay any extra or anything. Yeah, I mean, it looked like I could just set a new game.
Oh, so it's just there. Free DLC.
I think so. Don't know.
Now Blake's interested. Oh, I love a free DLC.
No, I'm just like,
I'm gonna buy this $140 game for the free DLC.
No, I'm just thinking that's so weird. Just be like, hey, here's this extra thing that nobody really knows about, or you didn't know you got.
Yuffie was like a big part, because she would just show up randomly in the first one. It was like this amazing thing where
specific you
wouldn't
combat
even
combat areas.
Yeah, yeah,
and you would have to say specific things to even progress the thing with her.
Running away.
Yeah, she would keep running away. Yeah. And there was like very specific dialogue options you had to choose. Yep. And then she would just, I think she would just join the party, right? As later on that she runs off. I
wonder if they...
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Later on, she steals your material and runs off to Wuta, and you've got to go get it.
I wonder if they'll do this for other characters. Like, what was the dog?
Red 13.
Because you just find him in some... facility, right, or something.
That's the facility,
the Shinra,
that you, yeah,
yeah,
headquarters.
When you're going to save,
what was he doing in before? Like, we need to know.
Find all of that out in the original game.
I don't remember. Yeah,
yeah,
well,
we
do it again.
Right?
You go to his village, and there's like a whole bunch of these dog things. But he was caught and used to as like a to basically to experiment.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, I don't remember that.
Why?
I remember his original name, at Nanaki.
Yeah, yes. Wow. Yeah.
Good game.
Yeah.
So, let's find out what the heck all those things that we just discussed are.
Yeah.
What's up with those ghosts? What's up with Yuffie's whole storyline? Paul, you're
to try that out.
You're our reporter on the scene here.
Yep.
Is it on PC?
I don't know.
I'm playing it on PlayStation.
It's on 5, eh? I mean, obviously, it's on 5. Yeah.
4. The
it did
the
launch version, with a PS4 version.
The first
version
is 4. Yeah. And here's the thing. I've heard that 5 doesn't actually play that well. I mean, sorry, the second one does not play that well on PlayStation 5.
What?
Yeah. They have this is so silly.
Oh, no.
They have two modes
to
play in. They've got graphics mode.
Oh, my God.
Which has like a real... I think if they say 30 frames per second,
yeah,
I would guess it probably drops below that.
Yeah.
And then performance mode, is 60 frames per second, but has like other performance issues.
What are we doing? You buy consoles so you don't have to worry about graphics.
I know.
Like,
imagine buying a console and having to go to the graphics setting for your game.
It's like, what are we doing?
Oh, dear.
I think I've seen this setting, and I think the default is performance mode. So I think a lot of people will just not know this is even there.
If it's only coming out on play,
they talk about it in the promotional materials.
Oh my god!
Yeah, I watched it. They have like a 10 or 15 minute like demo.
Graphics mode, right? Okay, you got graphics mode. Everything looks better, right?
Yeah.
But then, is there any way to upgrade your?
No, of course not. It's a console.
And like, why did they even add that?
So that they can relaunch it on the PlayStation 6.
Oh my god. That's some future thinking.
Well, you know what? I was just reading
they made this for the next it's next gen.
It's the new Crysis.
Oh jeez. Right?
Oh, can I run Final Fantasy VII Rebirth?
Yeah.
I hope it comes out on PC. Because I wouldn't mind playing it at some point and the likelihood of me buying PlayStation.
You know, crank those graphic settings all the way up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you, are you playing Persona on PC as well?
On Switch.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's very long. It's very good in some ways and kind of annoying in other ways.
Yeah.
The writing is interesting. There's so much writing in it.
Yeah.
There are novels and novels worth of writing.
Is it all voice acted?
No.
Ah.
I would say about a quarter of it is.
Ah,
like,
man.
All the important mainline stuff is voice acted.
Yeah.
And they have a really great function where you can, like, press a button to toggle, like, auto roll through the dialogue.
Yeah.
So, like, you don't have to hit the A button to go to the next person speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll just have their conversation and you can just sit back and listen.
That's nice.
Watch. Mm. And that works for non-voice acted stuff, but they kind of guess the speed for the non-voice acted.
Right.
The voice
act. Yeah.
It's just they finish talking and go to the next thing.
Is that do you think that is a Switch thing? That
the lack of voice acting?
Yeah.
No, I think it's a budget thing. Because
Because
I would say they probably have a good 50,000 words of voice acting, maybe more.
Yeah.
They have a lot of voice acting. Again, I'm not even halfway through the game. And tons and tons and tons of dialogue is voice acted. But there's just novels and novels worth of dialogue and writing.
Yeah.
And ignoring the space it would take on the game.
Like, it's just a lot
of audio files.
Yeah.
It would be hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, to get all that voice acting recorded, processed, hooked up. Like, that's an expensive. Hiring actors is expensive.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And they already have a lot of them. And they also do it for multiple languages. That's the other thing. Maybe in the Japanese version, it's all voice acted.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
But I will say that the quality of writing is inconsistent. Sometimes it's really good. And in particular, I think the voice acted stuff is usually pretty good.
Mm.
And then sometimes it dips into like weird, feels like maybe mechanical translation.
Oh, like, okay.
Like doesn't feel like it's, it's quite. It makes the person A says something in person. You have your dialogue choices feel a bit incongruous.
Right.
Mm.
Is that for sort of side, less important stuff?
Usually. Yeah.
It might just be even different translators, right?
It could. Yeah. I think there's a few things going on. I think that's part of it, Paul. And I think also part of it is maybe this is just a guess, the development cycle where they had their main storyline script ready first, and then and then got that overseas to get it like translated and start the VO recording process, and because they knew they weren't going to record everything, and so then they had like one set of translators for the main storyline stuff, and then a different set of translators for all the non-recorded stuff. That would be my guess.
Yep.
How do you feel about text to speech in doing that sort of thing for
games?
Yeah.
Bad. Look, there are solutions for it, and I've used some of them.
Yeah.
There's one called Replica that when I was working on Age of Darkness we were using.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it is bad.
Right.
It
Is that, has that, I've never really thought about text-to-speech all that much. Has that, do any of them, do they sound natural enough?
I'm sure you could get it to sound natural. The trouble is you can't, the amount of, it changes where the labor is going.
Mm.
It, a machine will take your inputs literally.
Yeah.
Right? So if I put all capitals because I want a character to shout.
Yeah.
A machine, like the AI may shout it.
Mm.
It might, but it's probably more likely to read out those letters.
Mm.
So like, and this happened where it would just be like A, B, L, L, O, L. And it was just like, that's not really what I was going for. If you've got weird punctuation or like if you're doing
trying
to do something stylistic, there's all this extra, these extra steps you have to do to make the machine get the results you want.
Yep. Like
where,
we living in New Zealand and the, you know, the navigation text, like speech thing.
Yes.
Just ruins multi-place names. Like it's horrendous.
Yes.
You know, so anything that I guess, I don't know how you'd have to,
trying to do a fantasy name with a weird character.
Yeah.
Any
Tolkien elvish names are just like wrecked. Yeah.
It's probably cheaper in the long run, but I think also the result is almost always going to be worse.
Probably not as good.
Yeah, I think it will always be bad. At least for a very long time.
Yeah.
Even with all that AI stuff, it's...
Even the best case AI stuff we have currently, where you have people doing like Joe Rogan reading things out on YouTube, those sorts of things.
And that still requires thousands of hours of...
listening to him.
Yeah, lots and lots and lots of audio samples.
Yeah, yeah.
And the result is convincing, but it also... It's usually one note, right? It's Joe Rogan's average speech pattern.
Yeah.
He won't get heightened.
Yeah.
He won't get angry. He won't get like sad.
Mm.
You know, it won't be, you won't get a unique performance out of that because there's no director saying, okay, now this is a moment where you've just found out this character's died or, you know, you're overjoyed. You're victorious. So you feel exuberant or whatever. There's no one giving context. And then there's no actor providing their own human elements. Right? It's what it's most useful for, in my experience, is in any game where you have to have, if there's like a cutscene or some sort of automated like dialogue progression,
and
there's timings sort of eyeballed.
Yeah.
So you can have an animator do some animations set to timings that might have a little bit of wiggle room, but they're not waiting for dialogue to happen 3 months. And then having to do 3 months worth of animation.
It also might be completely fine for having like in games where you have in sections where you have like a crowd or something, and there's just a few people saying muttering things off,
like the murmuring and ambient noise. Totally.
But
you can also do that very affordably with humans. There's a thing called loop group where you just get like six actors in a room and they'll shout.
In fact, there's probably like for most things like that, there's probably already samples somewhere.
Yeah, there'll be a thousand different sample things that you could get for that. I was talking about this. I was just thinking there's a game that came out called I can't remember what it's called now. But it is a detective game where you're trying to solve a murder and and all the characters, all their speech are AI driven.
Okay.
And you basically.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Minecraft-y one?
No, it doesn't look like Minecraft.
I know what you're talking about. I forget the name of it as well.
Vaudeville. I think it's called Vaudeville.
That rings a bell.
And you can hook up a mic and speak directly to it. And it's really weird.
Yep. Sometimes it's convincing.
Yeah, sometimes it's actually quite good. But then also you can just like make up stuff and it just takes it.
Yep.
Like you can say to someone, I talked to your wife and, you know, they told me this. And he'll be like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why my wife said that. Like normally she's blah, 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 whatever. Yep. And it just rolls with it.
Yeah.
So there's like this high level of like role playing, I guess, you know, and just making your own story and stuff like that.
Yep.
It's really weird.
I think there are more applications for like that sort of stuff is cool,
mm.
And no player is going to interpret that as this is a human talking.
Yeah.
Game, right.
Yeah.
It's it that yeah, game is a,
it's very clearly text to speech, of course.
Yeah. And, like, it's, and it's kind of about playing with the AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in that context, it's really cool and fun and interesting.
Mm.
And there are other games where AI dialogue trees and like that kind of stuff is core to its functionality.
Mm.
There's like a one about like a dinner party that gets really uncomfortable.
Oh, wow.
Years ago.
Interesting.
That's all really cool. And I think that is the best direction for sort of AI storytelling. I think trying to get a human-like performance,
yeah.
at least at this point, maybe in 10 years, there will be better tools for it.
I mean, it does seem a thing like humans will always just be better at it.
I think so.
I think that humans will be better at emulating humans than technology yeah. will.
You could probably get to a point where it will be it might match, but the amount of work on the person trying to
write the prompts.
Groom the AI,
yeah.
you know, to get the performance they want,
yeah.
it's going to be probably far more than a director sitting in
yeah,
the room with an actor.
Yeah.
Mm.
But it does end up being like, what's the cost, you know?
Yeah. If I mean, there could be I can imagine actually a world where you are talking to the AI and giving yeah. direction, and the direction is interpreted and, yeah. and acted upon.
I have seen people hook up AI in Mountain Blade
uh-huh.
and be able to just type, like, you know, talk to just one of the random people in a city, talk to them, and they will, like, they actually do a pretty decent job, like, of actually feeling like an actual, like, character, because you'll ask them, oh, where's the blacksmith, and they'll yeah. actually give you proper directions, because it's like
sure.
you know, fairly decent directions, but it's like
yeah.
it's better.
Fair, you have quick travel in that game,
yeah, sure, but
where's the blacksmith? Just use your quick travel.
Yeah,
why are you talking to me?
But I mean, you know that the civilian NPCs in that don't give really any real dialogue,
yeah,
so it is kind of a neat thing to be able yep. to be like, here's just like basically meaningless characters
yeah.
that you can just infuse some life into
yeah.
through AI. Yeah.
I think fleshing out the world is a really good use case, but there are big risks.
Mm.
Any time AI,
oh yeah, you don't know what it's gonna do.
Well, yeah, and it depending on where what its source of information is,
yeah.
it can get wacky.
What did,
or bad real fast?
Did you ever hear about the
Microsoft Twitter bot?
Oh yeah, that, but locally. Pack and Save had a AI on their website. Giving out recipes,
uh-huh.
you know, for things. So,
uh-huh.
and, you know, they, the first couple of days was good. Oh, gave no. out normal things. And then yeah. after a few days, it started giving recipes for
human
things
meat,
like
human meat, human meat, human meat, yeah. human meat.
It started giving recipes for things like bleach sandwiches.
Oh. And,
you know, and just weird stuff like that.
Well,
that,
we
like,
got to sell bleach
it.
And bread. What are we going to do
yeah.
with it?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, it's basically just recipes to make poison that will kill you. And,
yeah.
Yeah, they took it down. It made minor international news.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't hear about this.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
So the other issue I have with the idea of using AI for characters in games is that if you're trying to tell a story, it's much less interesting if it's not storytelling that you're engaging yeah. with.
Mm.
Like, whoever set out to make that character tell and if you didn't have something to set out to make that character like to fold into the story or yeah. whatever, then like you just shouldn't be able to talk to it.
Cause yeah.
otherwise you're going to be piecing together stuff that doesn't fit with everything else. And
yeah, I guess the problem I'm trying to solve is the, just repetitive dialogue from like civilian NPCs, you know, where it's like, I'm sick of hearing about this guard that could have been an adventurer if they hadn't taken an arrow to the knee.
Yeah.
You know? As funny and memeable that is, it's like, it's a clear just limitation of like, they've only got so much room for dialogue to be stored.
Yeah, but you're still going to have that same outcome even with AI, because it's still drawing upon a limited pool of information and your prompts.
Yeah.
And I think is still better than if it was taking your prompts and interpreting it and adding it to its pool, because then they can go way off the rails.
Yeah,
like I would rather it be limited than
everyone in Skyrim is racist.
Exactly, exactly. My like, mind. It would always spiral toward Nazism,
yeah.
Right?
It would. I mean, it would. Yeah,
especially if you're playing.
I mean, I always roleplay as
roleplay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just for the sake of libel laws, like not as far as we are aware, a Nazi.
Yeah.
Or I guess slander, not libel. Because it's not written down. All right. We're pretty much out of time.
Cool. Just finish on calling me racist.
No, I finished listening.
And in conclusion, Blake's a massive flaming Nazi. So,
to be fair, I specified for legal purposes
allegedly
that you are allegedly not. All right. If you want to tell us about your experiences with AI, why not? Email frenziedquestion@gmail.com. You can also just tell me how right or wrong I am about Elden Ring. That seems to be the current trend. And that's cool too.
I feel like it's winding down. I feel like we've basically you've said all there was to say.
No, that's not true at all. There's still plenty to
say. I was hoping it was true.
But I realize it could be exhausting for all parties involved. So I'm trying to wind it back. We'll be back probably in a couple weeks, right?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. See you then. Bye.
I vape now, yeah. I don't smoke anymore.
I would assume you smoked in high school.
No, I actually didn't smoke for quite a while. I didn't start smoking cigarettes until uni.
Now, you specified cigarettes there.
Yes.
You're on record.
One thing led to the other.
Yeah, you're recording, right? Yeah. Straight through the call.
This is live, yeah. This is the, let's admit to our crimes. Past crimes. You go first, Paul. We used to go around the town at night. We are admitting to crimes. I used to go around the town at night. Me and my mates would like drink at one of my mates' place and then walk into town. And we would do like petty vandalism.
Yep.
Like stealing road signs and road cones and like tearing down.
Kick down people's letterboxes.
Yeah, yeah. We had, there was a sign before you enter the town, the town name Kaikoui. And it was like, it had a light in it, like this big fluorescent light. And one of the guys just like went under there and pulled it out. And just we just had, and we would have them in our like, because we had a like drinking shed at my mate's place, and we would have these as trophies, like golf flags and road cones and random signs from around the town. What a time!
I definitely had a sign in my bedroom for quite a while.
I was such a good boy.
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Can't you tell?
I don't think you can. I don't think you can tell what people were like in high school based off what they're like now.
I was to the front. I would be the first one shoot my hands up, questions, class. Yeah, then I dropped out halfway through year 11.